the whole world is painting of a rice cake. Our assumption as sentient beings is that our experience conveys to us information about a real external world. But Buddha's insight is that it's not like that. So we think that there's food you can eat, and then there's maybe pictures of food, such as in a magazine. But the world of phenomena is actually like painting. The activity of the sense fields. You know about the sense fields? The organ. Its object and consciousness generate what we call the world. So the world is not so much taken in as generated. Which means that everything that we experience is it's kind of like a painting. An actual rice cake is something outside of our experience. What actually nourishes us, feeds us, is not something you can grasp. And ancient Buddha said that a picture of a rice cake can't satisfy hunger. And this has been taken to mean that, for instance, some people have taken this to mean that what's in the sutras is not actually nourishing. Our inspiring founder Dogen, however, rejects that interpretation. He says he encountered some people who had heard this saying that painting of a rice cake does not satisfy hunger. He said he encountered some skin bags. Who had heard this saying, and he said, they were not concerned about it. They said they treated it as someone else's gossip. He thought this was very sad. He invited us to study this saying much more carefully. He says, hunger is also a painting. Whether, he says, you're painting mountains and rivers, or you're painting a rice cake, that determines what colors you use. Yielding up its true colors is realization. And realization reveals that the world is a painting of a rice cake. So we are all painters. There is no discontinuity in our being and that of the Buddhas and ancestors. They too are painters. Therefore, hunger and its satisfaction are both paintings of a rice cake. Another way to say it is, rice cake and hunger arise simultaneously, in dependence on one another. Neither has own being, as Buddha taught. Neither has independent existence. Both are part of a painting. So the only thing that can satisfy hunger, which is a painting, is a painted rice cake. This is a radically different view of the world and our experience. So if you're feeling perplexed, don't let your feeling of being perplexed confuse you. Don't be led by that. Somebody asked Master Yunman, what do you have to say about going beyond Buddha and transcending the ancestors? And Yunman answered, a sesame rice cake. Sometimes people will commemorate this saying by painting a rice cake. And to look at such a painting is to have our hunger eased. There's this saying, you know, about the iron person. You know, you've heard of the iron person. As part of the in the Dharma transmission ceremony, there's a phrase that appears, which is single utterance, iron person. Lives here. Sometimes translated, one phrase, iron person, lives here. Some people think that that means that someone who practices a very long time becomes an iron person. But this is a shallow view. The one who practices is always the iron person. The one who is nourished by a painting of a rice cake is always the iron person. This is not the result of sitting a long time in the cold or going hungry. Wearing patched clothing. All of those things are fine, but they just honor the iron person who's already there. And iron doesn't mean, you know, insensitive or inflexible or cold or dead. Iron simply means untroubled by worldly concerns. Not necessarily that there aren't any, just that they're not troubling. If you do the calligraphy for one phrase, iron person lives here, you have another painted rice cake. probably seen paintings of bamboo. Somehow in Asian art, bamboo appears very often. Dogen's teacher, Ru Jing, said, bamboo is tall. The banana plant is short. So you could paint this. Tall bamboo, short banana plant. And that would be just right. Tall bamboo, short banana plants. Another rice cake. Another painting. So this is exactly our life, you know, where we live. This is exactly the realm of the iron person. This is why a painting of a rice cake can quiet our heart. This is why the Buddha's ancestors spent so much time painting rice cakes for us. This rice cake, Dogen said, has nothing to do with coming or going. Rice cake doesn't turn as the world appears to turn. And this is such a joyful realization that sometimes artists will make a painting. Or poets will write a poem. Musicians will make music. So that's how it is. I don't know how it looks to you. Maybe it looks different. But another way of talking about studying this perplexing saying about a rice cake is, we also call it zazen. What we can see and describe of zazen is a kind of painted rice cake also. When we're actually sitting, it can be very hard to say much about what's going on. because practice and realization are inseparable. It's not like you can have some sitting, and then from that vantage point you can see various cool things happening. Well, maybe people are getting bored, so perhaps that's enough. But maybe you have some questions. Speak up a little.
Oh, it just seems in some ways then that all paintings are rice cakes.
I think you could say that. And not just paintings, but all kinds of things. Is that a hand back there?
Sorry, yeah. I wasn't getting bored. You said that sitting, it's not like you get to see cool things.
Well, you could, but that's not actually sitting.
Cool,
I mean, you might think I'm seeing cool things and I'm sitting, but that's kind of neither here nor there.
And you said that the iron person lives here. Conveys not being troubled by the world.
Yeah, basically not being troubled by troubles.
Well, if you're not troubled by troubles, what are you going to be troubled by?
Well, actually the Buddhas aren't troubled at all. Not even a little bit. They may see, oh look, there's troubles, but that does not trouble them. They simply respond, go to work. I suppose possibly one of the things they might see is they have some feeling that could be called trouble. But being Buddhas, they're not misled by that. They know that's a painting of a rice cake. And that the actual nourishment of that arising is ungraspable. So this is a bit challenging, but then from the perspective of our habitual sentient being consciousness, whatever that is, we might find it so. Yes.
Relating to what Larry there said, there's some story about that. After the Buddha was enlightened, there a war was declared on his country, and Buddha's response to this was to cry. So how do we understand that in light of his not being troubled?
Well, I'm not sure. Do you think if there are tears, it means trouble?
I think he might have been troubled. I mean,
I think he was just crying.
Well, it's an equivocal term, you know, troubled and so
trouble
is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, and I mean, in the image of the Iron Man,
yes,
the iron person is somewhat incompatible with this story.
Oh,
or at least you think not at all.
No.
Okay.
An iron person crying is just that.
Hmm.
An iron person crying. And there may be some rust, you know, the tears and the salt, but again, this is untroubling. Trouble basically means dukkha. And Buddhas have no truck with that anymore. They are not glamored by dukkha any longer. Sentient beings? Yes.
Glamoured?
Glamoured. Enchanted.
Mm.
Bedazzled. Buddhas are very clear about dukkha and its end. Sentient beings, a little bit fuzzy on that point. So, when sentient beings are troubled, they may actually reify and establish a thing called trouble and relate to it that way. Buddhas don't do that. When Buddhas cry, it's just crying. That's all.
But cry comes from an emotion,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
So that means that you must be feeling some...
Sure. Sure. My understanding is, it's not that Buddhas have no feelings. I think that's a misinterpretation, and sometimes you hear that. Buddhas never experience any fluctuation that an ordinary being could recognize as such. I personally don't accept that. But Buddhas are very clear about the nature of their experience. And that is an important difference. Yes.
Okay. You know, I get the image here that basically the entire universe is somehow reducible to what goes on inside of me. And I can...
Wait a minute. Reducible? I didn't say that.
I said that.
Okay. Let's just be clear here.
In other words, it's all basically what's going on inside myself, my universe.
Well,
my universe. It's the me thing.
It's a me thing.
Right.
Well, there's certainly an aspect of a me thing happening there for sentient beings. But it's more like what's called you and what's called the universe simultaneously co-arise. So that's a little different.
No, I'm just talking about the way it feels, what I'm
uh-huh.
hearing you.
Okay.
You know, and so there's, what I'm saying is, it's basically a two-minded thing going on as
mm-hmm.
I listen. And that is that, all of what happens is basically an experience within myself, from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And yet suffering in the world is a very real phenomenon, at
mm-hmm.
least as far as I can. It seems to connect us to the world here.
Suffering.
Right. And
mm-hmm.
it does have a real effect to this little universe inside myself.
Yes. In other words, you witness suffering and you have some response.
Yes.
Okay.
And I guess, I doubt if I'm ever going to get to the position where I'm totally detached from this. I don't think Buddhahood's in my immediate future. But sometimes when I am staring at the wall, I do get a piece of it, a taste of it.
Of?
This Buddhahood thing.
Oh.
And it's a nice thing, but I think basically it's very important that even if a person did become a Buddha, that suffering is a very important connection
mm-hmm.
to the real world of most sentient beings.
Absolutely. I'm sure you've heard of the Bodhisattva vow.
Right.
So, as long as there are any suffering beings, we will have work to do.
Okay.
So that's inarguable from the point of view of our vows. But there are these teachings, you know, that there is nothing that is not the self. There are not phenomena and a self as witness. That is wrong view, according to Buddha. So I just want to be careful about that distinction.
I'm probably harboring a great many wrong views.
Well, some of those wrong views are extremely subtle, not just yours, mine too, and require, or anyway, respond to the subtle solvent of Zazen as their impact and their karmic energy is attenuated over time. How long? I don't know. But all of that that I just said, that's painting of a rice cake. Yes.
Who are these Buddhas who are not troubled?
Sorry?
Who are these Buddhas who are not troubled?
Well, I don't know. Whoever they are. Wherever they are. Would you like to introduce us to some? Or do you have business cards for some of these Buddhas?
No.
No? Remember, what I'm trying to say is Buddhas are not troubled by trouble.
That sounds kind of like a bodhisattva who gives gifts is not a bodhisattva who gives gifts. It's like a Buddha who is troubled by trouble is not a Buddha who is troubled.
Well, a bodhisattva who gives gifts thinking I'm giving a gift.
Right, that's my point. Yeah.
Is got a little problem.
Yeah.
Something like that. A bodhisattva who gives gift without any particular establishment of giver, receiver, or gift, that's different. Remember, Buddha had a headache too one day because he smacked a fish on a head on its head in a previous lifetime, so he had a headache. So, but I suggest he wasn't particularly troubled by that; he just had a headache. If we understand trouble as a painting of a rice cake, we may not be so troubled.
Same with hunger?
Hmm?
You're saying same with hunger? If we think of hunger as just a painting of a rice cake and we don't care about it?
Well, we should study hunger as a painting of a rice cake. And then see what that does to our experience. Dogen is constantly urging us to study. You know, he says in this same essay that I was reading, and elsewhere, he says, you study one thing completely, you're studying everything. Meeting and mastering one thing is to master everything completely. So if we study hunger in the way that we're taught in this little family, it's like studying the whole universe.
What does it mean to study? Just see how it feels and observe it? Or?
Well, one of the things we say is, if I'm studying hunger, I'm not approaching it, and I'm not avoiding it. I'm letting it be exactly as it is and watching with this whole body mind. That's one way to talk about study. That's Zazen, basically. Well, the next couple of Saturdays, you'll have visiting speakers, so maybe they will say stuff that's a little less gnarly. Anyway, I'm just talking about the stuff that I like to talk about. And you may always complain, say, would you stop talking about this stuff? It's really obnoxious and doesn't make any sense and makes me hate Buddhism. So,
actually just made me hungry.
It made you hungry. That
we can
deal
with.
Do you actually get complaints like that?
Actually, it'd be great if I got complaints. Sometimes as I hear secondhand those complaints, and that is not so good.
Yeah, that's
but I welcome all such complaints. Would you please shut up, because you're driving us crazy. And I would love to hear about that. But usually people don't come across with the goods that way. They vote with their feet. And they're entitled to vote with their feet. Did you?
Yeah, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that you were talking about hungry, and I was thinking of how about regarding the suffering of others?
Of others?
Yeah, when you see other people suffering,
mm-hmm.
and you don't relate to their suffering, and you feel nothing, you basically don't feel it.
Uh-huh.
Is it like a selfish thing to feel? Or?
Well, probably that means that, you know, in this world, we spend a certain amount of time protecting ourselves from how much suffering there is. And once that becomes a habit, then our natural response, which is actually to feel the suffering of others in our own body, is diminished. So if we see some suffering and we have no response at all, my guess is we do have a response, and we've kind of pushed it aside. As I've said before, compassion means that we don't do that. We don't push it aside. And that when we witness suffering, we allow it to resonate in this body mind. That's actually compassion. And the response, who knows what the response will be. Give somebody a sandwich, or I don't know what it'll be. Depends on the circumstances. But the price of deadening ourselves to all the suffering in the universe is severe. And it cripples us. And it kills us, even. So it's very important that we not do that. And one of the effects of practice is the body-mind again becomes permeable to the suffering of other beings, which is sometimes uncomfortable. Even Suzuki, she said, somebody asked him a question about, you know, there, back in the day when Tassajara was new and people were, you know, they had some kind of intense experience in the winter down there, and then they come back to the city and they would just find it like kind of overwhelming. And somebody said, you know, now I feel like I'm riding the bus and I have these, like a horse wears these things. So they don't, I don't know what it's about, like seeing other horses or something. I feel like I kind of have to do that when I'm on the bus, otherwise it's overwhelming. And Suzuki Gyoroshi said, well, that may be part of the price we pay for living in the city. So if you wander around all the time, weeping. You know.
Oh, it's just terrible, terrible. The suffering,
you know. Probably you'll get locked up because people will start to think you are one of those non-functional beings who needs extra attention. But there was that, remember, there is that bodhisattva, Sadaprarudita, who's constantly weeping as a result of the suffering of beings. So this is a known archetype, you know. If we were actually attending to and responding to all of the suffering around, we'd sit around and cry all the time. Fortunately, there are other ways of responding also. But to reverse this kind of karmic deadening that happens, this thickening of the hide, is an important effect of practice. And the results can be a little challenging. Often when I'm out in the street, I'll feel like crying and I'll see something, you know. Sometimes I do. And it's very embarrassing. Excuse me, I'm weeping at the suffering of the world. Some people understand that, you know. Some of the people like down on Market Street living in cardboard boxes, they understand right away. But some of our more sophisticated folks, it's like, could you take an Ativan, please? You're troubling us with your weeping about the suffering of the world. So.
I feel like that all the time.
Yeah.
Especially in the work
that you do. You must see a lot of it.
Daily.
So it's like, this is...
Sometimes you do get kind of just exhausted by
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I'm
it's
sure.
To stay grounded and function and,
yeah.
You know, moment to moment.
Yeah, yeah. And Larry, maybe in your clinic work, sometimes it must be overwhelming. It's like, this person is a mess. Maybe I'll give him a Band-Aid. That's all I can do. Isn't that rather painful?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but also I find people who are just in the worst possible circumstances by any objective standard who are in a much better mood than I am.
Uh-huh. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Well, so it's very important that even when, you know, things are awkward and uncomfortable and making us seem to be very sad, that we continue this study of the rice cake. This constant study is the heart of Zazen. And again, study just means don't fall into, don't pull away, just see it. This is the natural function of the iron person, who can also weep. Okay, so now we're going to feed you some non-painted rice cakes, and you can continue your study. Thank you very much for your patience.